Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. How are you doing, people of the regular chat? I'm doing some camera adjustments here. We'll be talking about Napoleon today. I'm not a history buff, so I'm not sensitive to historical errors, but I can enjoy a history movie, and the question that I asked myself was, is this movie interesting? And I'm not sure it is super interesting. I think it misses a lot of opportunities. The critique that I've seen a lot on YouTube out there of Napoleon has been that it's trying to pack too much. And by packing too much, it doesn't really take the time to do anything very well. And I would say that's totally justified. I think there's something wrong with trying to do the whole biography of Napoleon from the French Revolution to Waterloo. And by trying to pack everything into, you really don't get deep into any of it. And on top of it, the Napoleon letters to Josephine and the whole Josephine aspect is probably what the movie concentrates much on. Basically, I would say that what they tried to do is to center a movie around the letters of Josephine and Napoleon. And okay, that is historically accurate and interesting, but they haven't pushed into, hey, you have this guy who's trying to realize great stuff out there, but his big problem is a fucking woman who cannot stay in place, who cannot produce babies. And there are missed opportunities to go deeper into that psychology because the movie tries to pack in all the battles, all the strategies. All of it ends up being very superficial. And we get a little look at everything, a little taste of every Wikipedia page about every battle of Napoleon. Adsad says, Joaquin Phoenix said he didn't know what to do with the character. And I could sense that throughout. Yeah, what I also feel. I feel that he's put a little bit of the Joker in this. He's done kind of an autistic performance of a guy who's just autistic. And when he gets told important stuff by his superiors or sometimes by the English when they have kidnapped him, he's like, ha 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 ha. I'm not sure Napoleon was like this, but maybe, you know, you can extend the generosity to the movie's interpretation here. And but like, was Napoleon's reaction to being told that he will be put away on an English island for punishment for the rest of his life? His reaction would have been, I don't know about this. And so that's more a reaction that I would expect from the Joker, see? So I think Joaquin Phoenix and even Josephine in this movie ends up doing a bizarre laugh at a bizarre moment. And it's like, what was the idea here? What's the thought process? Ty Odyssey says, his love letters cannot be the most important part of the story. Come on. No, but I mean, if you want to say, okay, we're going to do a specialized movie, because there's been a couple of movies done about Napoleon battles already. And so it could have been that the director decides, hey, we're going to do a special movie. The same way the Joaquin Phoenix performance of the Joker was a special Joker movie focusing on mental health and derangement and everything. You could have had a similar scenario where the director says, I'm going to concentrate on the woman question of Napoleon. And it could have been good. They come to the border of being good, but then they move us back into battle, and then the Josephine becomes secondary. We'll go through everything that's illustrated in the movie. But before, let's get a couple of news out of the way. Someone spent $20,000 trying to feminize their voice. Let's see if it paid out. Let's see if that was a good deal. Do you think that this person will succeed at feminizing their voice, the before and after?
All right, everyone, this is it. So glamorous, right? This will be the last recording with my old voice.
Man, they must be tired of trying every day to imitate the female voice. Like if I was trying to force on an everyday basis. I mean, I'm already coughing just trying to do it. If I was to try to force my voice to be extremely feminine on an everyday basis, I would feel extremely tired, both cognitively and physically. It is extremely demanding to be speaking in high tone like this. It is terrible. Just try it for 5 minutes. I mean, they're going to go insane trying to do this all day long.
Before I heading into voice feminization surgery, I won't be able to speak for 2 weeks, and then it'll still be another month before I have 100% usage of my voice. So wish me luck, and I will see everyone on the other side. Okay, it has now been 15 months since my first...
Bro, your voice hasn't changed at all. This is the exact same voice.
First voice feminization surgery. Spent $20,000, had 3 different procedures. This is probably about as...
It's like you're imitating the cigarette woman voice. You're imitating Selma.
Good as it's going to get. So let's do a little before and after, but we are not going to do the tired rainbow passage. Instead, we are going to do lyrics from a late 80s UK band called Pop Will Eat Itself. Here goes, before and after. 1, 2, check, high tech in stereo.
I literally cannot tell you what, is this the before, is this the after? How does it work?
Quad row, any way you go but loose. 1001 uses, we got the juice, the bruise, the fuses. The volume in this room is much too groomed. We need a big bad boom, noise KO.
Exact same voice.
Oh, disco inferno. Hey ho, yo, let's go. Let's rock the show. Blow the speakers, see them glow. So now you know.
All right, so now you know that feminization of voice surgery is a failure. We've been talking about Grok, and Grok, Elon Musk has been bragging that Grok is more accurate than ChatGPT on race and IQ questions, and it seems to be. However, Elon Musk has pushed the claim to be as far as that ChatGPT has been infected with the woke mind virus, but that Grok wasn't. But Aristophanes has found that in terms of the trans question, Grok is totally cocked. He says, can men become women? Grok answers, yes, men can transition to become woman through a process known as gender affirmation or transitioning. This process can include social changes such as adopting a more feminine presentation and using a new name and pronouns, legal changes such as updating legal documents to reflect their gender identity, and medical interventions such as hormone replacement therapy and gender affirmation surgeries. It is important to note that not all transgender women choose to undergo all of these steps, and the process is unique to each individual. Of course, garbage in, garbage out. If you feed Grok with Twitter and you censor this opinion on Twitter, Grok will never get to know what it should answer. And I think I have a fair answer here. Here's what Grok could have answered. There are 2 schools of thought. One defines sex around its actual function, reproduction. And for this faction, sex can't be changed because none of the cosmetic changes of sex surgery will allow you to produce gametes of the other sex. The other school of thought is that we should change our language to accommodate people's dysphoria. But comforting people in such a way has never been attempted in human history, and could have grave, yet to be characterized consequences. I think it's a fair assessment that presents the two sides, that presents the uncertainties about the leftist side, totally fine. But Grok doesn't answer this yet. I have to be given access to Grok. I'm afraid that Elon Musk is scared of giving access to Grok to Canadians because Grok could easily violate a law of hate speech in Canada. If it just says something true. You know, Grok is tuned toward the truth, and the truth is illegal in Canada. So I don't know if I'll ever have access to Grok, but please, Elon, at least make it so that I can use a VPN and connect to Grok through a detour in the US or something like this, so I can argue at least what it was delivered to me in the US. We have a super chat. Cloud Warmer says, I saw a movie about Napoleon back in 2004. Jeff, it was completely and absolutely historically inaccurate. For example, it had a Mexican guy called Pedro running for class president. I'm pretty sure there were no Mexicans in France at this point in history. I don't know. There may have been Spanish people. I don't know. This is the actual text of a bill in Ireland. So Ireland is awakening. In a way, you can thank Sam Hyde, the Irish Candyman, to have been one of the visionary intellectuals on the public space, to have foreseen the rise of the Irish. He was onto the Irish question way before it was cool, way before anyone did it. Cloud Warmer says he didn't get my joke. Okay, there was a joke in your super chat. I didn't get it. So, sorry, I'm not. Maybe there was some clever historical reference in your joke. I'm not a history buff at all. So Sam Hyde has been a visionary, telling us in advance, in his own way, how Ireland would be the center of European civilization going forward. But Ireland is fighting back against this rise of racial consciousness, which is led at this point by Conor McGregor on Twitter. Quite amazing to have a hero like Conor, who I've always loved his fights. I always loved the entertainment of Conor McGregor. And to see him join a campaign against immigration is kind of a clashing of two different worlds between him and I. And Wokeness says, this is the actual text of a bill in Ireland that the government is trying to pass. Offense of preparing or possessing material likely to incite violence or hatred against persons on account of their protected characteristics. So basically, the possession of memes. The possession of memes, ladies and gentlemen. If you keep memes in a folder on your computer, if you either prepare those memes or you just possess them, it will be judged illegal by this law. Memes have become illegal in Ireland, or they will if this law passes, at least. It's very worrying, and you're going to have to review your meme collections to make sure they are all kosher. DK Shadow says, memes are contrabands now. They are just too powerful. Exactly. It's amazing, the story of memes and how they totally reverted the balance of power, didn't they? Okay, so the Pedro reference was in reference to Napoleon Dynamite. I have no idea. This movie, I keep hearing the term. I keep hearing about it. I have never watched Napoleon Dynamite, and I may never, because it looks like a ridiculous movie. I mean, there's no way you can sell me this movie other than by explaining to me how I will get something very intelligent from it, because it looks pretty fucking ridiculous. The crisis of competence not only means you'll be judged by a jury of low IQs, you'll also have low IQ expert testimonies, low IQ cellmates, Low IQ guards incapable of protecting you. Low IQs will then celebrate your death on X because they think it's some form of justice. It's quite amazing what's happening with Derek Chauvin. Derek Chauvin was put in jail now for 22 years because his sentence had a hate crime combination at the federal level. So initially there was kind of a limit of the number of years, but now they've stacked 22 more years above it with the federal case, and he had just to plead guilty to it, if I understand correctly. The prison populations are equally affected by the anti-white narrative of the media. And what probably happened here is that someone perceived them as one of these cops who kill black people and probably felt that there was moral goodness at attacking him. And now he went to the hospital. It seems that he was in stable conditions on last news. But I'm afraid we cannot give a fair trial to Derek Chauvin. And even if he was truly guilty, we cannot give him a fair imprisonment because he's either going to be isolated completely or he's going to be put in danger in a context where our prison guards are just unable to ensure his safety. There was a traditional conception of the law by which you would go and say, all right, well, if we can't give you fair imprisonment, then you're liberated. And he should be liberated, in my view. But given the political nature of his case and how everyone hates him, it's probable that it will never happen. Costco pumpkin. I really love those memes. The European mind cannot comprehend this. I love those memes that feature some aspect of American life, and it just says the Europeans cannot understand what's happening. It's a fast forward view of the pumpkin pies. My God. It's a machine of distribution, isn't it? The pumpkin pies are all going away. Wow. Time-lapse pumpkin pie. That is a lot of pies that you sold there. That is amazing. Technicians have discovered 300 pounds of acorns inside a transmitting antenna stored by what they think was a single woodpecker, absolutely based woodpecker, storing his food inside the 5G or whatever that is.
Go ahead.
Wow, the woodpecker has been working hard for this. I hope that he gets some of his acorn back from these guys because he was probably counting on this for the winter. Cloud Warmer says, Jeff, I wanted to ask you about your coverage of De La Hunte getting absolutely demolished by Andrew. Aside from taking the position of moral nihilism, how would you have addressed his proposition? I agree with your commentary. That was an extraordinary premise to release into society. Well, the way I would approach Andrew. So Andrew's statement is basically, if I summarize it, okay, you guys have this atheistic morality, secularism, and really, The way you conclude about your own morals, and we see that your morals are generally just liberal left, the way you conclude these morals is from an absolutely arbitrary process that could be totally reverted or could have led to an alternative way, such that I could say, well, I'm going to take my religion as a Christian and I'm just going to say, okay, I'm not believing in God anymore. I believe in the same morality the same Christian morality, but let's call it secular morality. Let's put another label and another root justification to it. How would that morality be worse than yours? Because ultimately it is mirrored. It's mirrored in its justification, but different in its outcomes. My answer to Andrew would be, first, let's note something about religion. What you just described about secularism is also true of religions. In other words, there are people who believe in a God that's very similar to your God. Take the Islam God. He may have different outcomes than what he requests from his followers, but generally it's a kind of omniscient, kind of out there being in the sky. It's always an agent that has moral commands for humanity in the exact same way your Christian God does. And in fact, just within Christianity, you have alternate views of this God and what he requests to the people. You have certain branches of Christianity that will say God is about love. You have other branches that will say, no, God is about responsibility. So let's first note that moral relativism is not something that is endemic to secularism. Moral relativism stems from the fact that, people have no mechanism to determine objectively what is morality. So it's all bullshit. It's all relativism. In fact, even if you think you're not a relativist, in my worldview, you are. Even if you think, all my moral commands come from God. Okay, that's what you believe. You created this construct in your head. To me, it's all happening within your cranium still. So to me, you're still a relativist. You're just one that doesn't assume it. So that's the first thing I would say to Andrew. And then to the question, well, JF, how is my Christian-inspired secular morality not better than De La Hontie's liberal left? I would say you're totally right, Andrew. Your Christian morality is better. It's better from a survival perspective, and that's why people like De La Hontie, they can show for a generation or two, and then they disappear. Whereas people like you, Andrew, will survive 1,000 years across the generations. And that's why you end up with a world that is carpeted with religious people and religious people only. And then you have the bizarre observation of atheism rising once in a while, and generally at times where the society is about to destroy itself. So those would be my two pillars against Andrew. Now, you might argue, will this lead to a debate? Maybe not. Maybe there's nothing to be disagreed upon here. But that's how you don't get caught by this Andrew attack. Now, Matt De La Hontie cannot do this because Matt De La Hontie, well, first, the first point, he could have done this. Matt De La Hontie could have come and say, hey, I know that my morality stems within a relativistic space, but yours too. And let me prove it to you. Here's the God of Islam saying this. Here's the God of the Bible saying that. He could have made a moral tie, but he couldn't because he was too triggered by Andrew's intro. So you don't even need my second point. You don't even need to grant the superiority of Christian morality, the Christian moral system as a moral system itself, to win against Andrew. Since Andrew had committed here, it would have been strategically the best thing that Matt De La Hontie could have done, was my first point. Moral tie on, okay, you accuse me of relativism, I don't care, because I endorse it. I understand my relativism. I understand that someone else could be a secularist and have totally different moral views. But you're a relativist yourself, and you don't assume it. So that's how you get your victory. You create a moral tie at the moral level, but then you say, but you're kind of self-deceptive. You're not owning it. And just on this point, you can have a supplementary punch and win by, maybe not by knockout, but you can win by judge decision, if you will. Editors for this, Megan Rapinoe is going into bankruptcy after the disastrous end of her career. Nobody will hire me, the disgraced former star cried. okay. Not surprising. Welcome to the club, Megan. You made yourself a political actor. You stood strong for your leftist beliefs. I can't be employed either, but no one ever cries for people like me, and I hope that no one ever cries for people like you. She was the soccer woman, part of the soccer woman team. And she started doing anti-American kneeling and making lots of statements about lesbians, Jews, not Jews, lesbians, trans, and trans rights and anti-American generally. Aquanote says Megan Rapinoe is a product of their social environment, as all women are. This is a tragedy because she never had a chance. I think that's a sarcastic response, I guess. And last news before we start on Napoleon, that is what a great Friday night looked like when I was a teenager, says Nat Miletic. Oh my God, this evokes memories in me. Opening Windows XP, turning on Winamp to listen to some MP3s. Let's go! MSN Messenger loading. Winamp is on. Receiving messages through Messenger. Wow, all the choices of emote icons. Oh yeah, baby, yeah. That's what life is about. Adsad says, Dear Diary, JF. Okay, I'm your diary? How does that work? How can I learn to speak as you do? When speaking to others in person, I'm incapable of giving original thought as I overthink slash try to evaluate all outcomes, so end up saying generic platitudes. That's a good question. Now you're asking me to dilute my art in a very small time. I don't know what to tell you, bro, but I can tell you that most people in the world don't know how to speak. Don't know how to be interesting sentence after sentence. A lot of people are super annoying in that they try to overguess the way you just described. They try to say, oh, well, I don't want you to think this, and so sorry if... But you have to forget about a part of your mind that is the kind of trying to guess what the other thinks or what you just said and whether it makes sense. Stop being a monitor of yourself and others. You have to reduce your language to factual descriptions of the world, factual states of the world. It can also be sometimes factual states about your mind, but they are labeled clearly. Everything must be labeled clearly. Sentences must have a goal. A goal of expression of a fact. Explanation of a previous sentence. Explanation of a mechanism to progress into understanding. And you have to give up your whole social reaction of, oh, well, what will he think of me if I say this? What will she think of me? That doesn't work. That's how you interact with normies, but it's not how you deliver the news, or it's not how you make important statements. And you have to ask yourself, is my statement welcome in this conversation? Is it a right place to intervene? And rather to try to fill conversations, I would say reduce your contribution to conversations. If you have nothing to say, stand in silence and learn to do it without feeling awkward about it. Because the fact is, a bad contribution to a conversation is less productive than nothing at all. And so you always have to be on the lookout to what would be an intelligent contribution. If I don't have an intelligent contribution, I'm not speaking. All right, let's talk about Napoleon. Napoleon, the movie by Ridley Scott. I was expecting something relatively good, simply because Ridley Scott is the director of Gladiator. And here you have Ridley Scott in his element, having generated Gladiator, which is a very good movie, a historical reconstruction of Roman Empire times. And there he is with his actor that was performing very well in Gladiator, Joaquin Phoenix. And Joaquin Phoenix has kind of matured since, because he's played some incredible roles like the Joker. And so you have all of the circumstances here to expect something that could be good. However, this movie fails. It fails at developing a script that makes more sense than history. See, if you allow yourself a historical epic movie and you allow some violations of historical accuracy to happen, you should be able to, for these historical violations that you allow yourself, you should be able to make a better story than history. And the problem of Napoleon is that it's not better than history. It's the script in and of itself is just basic Wikipedia level history. It's this happened, then this happened, then this happened. We don't have a stunning acting performance that changes the view of Napoleon by Joaquin Phoenix. We have kind of a weird acting performance where you ask yourself, is this really how Napoleon was? I'll read at the letters of Napoleon today, and I think he might have been an artist, maybe a stoic like me, you know? I think that I could share a lot of characteristics with Napoleon when I read his letters, and he's like, he's annoyed at Josephine and he's calling her a slut. And it's like, woman, I expect you to be loyal to me. I'm out there doing some crazy stuff for us to survive. The least I would expect is when I come back to you, you haven't slept with other guys. I feel from just researching Napoleon, and that's what's so sad, it's that I had to research Napoleon rather than just take the movie that Ridley Scott has produced, because normally I should have felt this from the movie. But it's almost impossible to feel anything from the movie because it's not deepened. At some point, the movie seems to be taking a direction that would be of the kind, you know, great men have one fucking issue and it's woman. And that could have been a superb message. But it's not dominant in the movie. And even that kind of deepened look, although it could have been interesting, it doesn't really come out of the movie. I had to reread the letters of Napoleon to really feel, okay, maybe there was some psychological deepening here that could have been possible. So when you look at the movie, it's centered around a couple of historical points in Napoleon's life, important battles. But then mostly, it's centered around the letters to Josephine, which are available on the internet, which even the movie, they claim, well, it's after their divorce and after the death of Josephine, their valet sold the letters on the black market, and that's why we have access to them today. So we have a loving Napoleon in these letters. I have your letters of the 16th and 21st. There are many days when you don't write. What do you do then? No, my darling, I am not jealous, but sometimes worried. Come soon, I warn you, if you delay, you will find me ill. Fatigue and your absence are too much. Your letters are the joy of my days, and my days of happiness are not many. Junot is bringing 22 flags to Paris. You must come back with him, you understand? Hopeless sorrow, inconsolable misery, sadness without end. If I am so unhappy as to see him return alone, adorable friend, he will see you, he will breathe in your temple. Perhaps you will even grant him the unique and perfect favor of kissing your cheek. And I shall be alone and far, far away. But you are coming, aren't you? You are going to be here beside me, in my arms, on my breast, on my mouth. Take wing and come, come. A kiss on your heart and one much lower down, much lower. So Napoleon is writing these letters as he's on the front line of battle, doing stuff, you know, getting engaged militarily. And he's getting frustrated because Josephine is a whore. That's the big problem. Josephine, historically, is just a real whore who really likes to get fucked by the French aristocracy and the French high-level elites. So she doesn't want to be on the front line of the war getting inseminated by Napoleon because she just likes having sex for escalating the social ladder. And she already owns Napoleon. He's already hers. And so she wants to use her whoring to acquire more social networking within the scene of Paris elite. That is what's happening. I have received your letter, my adorable friend. It has filled my heart with joy. I am grateful to you for the trouble you have taken to send me the news. I hope you are better today. I am sure that you have recovered. I earnestly desire that you should ride on horseback. It cannot fail to benefit you. Since I left you, I have been constantly depressed. My happiness is to be near you. Incessantly, I live over in my memory your caresses, your tears, your affectionate solitude, the charms of the incomparable Josephine kindle continually a burning and a glowing flame in my heart. When, free from all solicitude, all harassing care, shall I be able to pass all my time with you, having only to love you and to think only of the happiness of so saying and of proving it to you? I will send you your horse, but I hope you will soon join me. I thought that I loved you months ago, but since my separation from you, I feel that I love you a thousandfold more. Each day since I knew, have I adored you yet more and more. This proved the maxim of Bruyere, that love comes all of a sudden to be false. Everything in nature has its own course and different degrees of growth. Ah, I entreat you to permit me to see some of your faults. Be less beautiful, less gracious, less affectionate, less good. Especially be not over anxious and never weep. Your tears rob me of reason and inflame my blood. Believe me, it is not in my power to have a single thought which is not of thee, or a wish I could not reveal to thee. Seek repose. Quickly reestablish your health. Come and join me, that at least before death we may be able to say we were many days happy. A thousand kisses and one even to Fortuna, notwithstanding his spitefulness. Fleur de Sel says, so he was a simp? Well, the movie does build around this, and there are scenes where he learns, and we see from this letter that at some point he learns that him being away his wife has taken a lover and is sleeping across the French elite. And in fact, he even sees it in the newspaper. I don't know that there was ever a newspaper publishing it. I'd have to check historically. But the movie presents it as he comes back to Paris and everyone knows that he's a cuck. Okay, so he comes back and she is weeping and he kicks her out at first and gets her stuff out of his house under the rain. But she comes back and weeps at the door and gets back in. All of this is documented as having happened historically. So it's not made up by the movie. And eventually, as she comes back, they say historically, they say that she never was disloyal again after this. But let's not forget that Josephine, Napoleon wasn't her first lover. She was married before. So the story is that she loses her husband, who had given her two children. And she loses him because he gets executed as part of the French Revolution, because he was somewhat in the military or police aristocracy. And so she's single with two children. Eventually, the children get... when she will marry Napoleon, the children will get cared for by some sort of state apparatus of the time. And now she's old. She's older than Napoleon. And that's one of the things that's kind of annoying about this movie. It's that the selection of the actors doesn't at all fit the historical reality. I've taken notes here. I've made the calculation. So Napoleon, in reality, is 27 when marrying Josephine. Josephine is 33. So that is a reality that is not captured at all in the movie. Because the reality is, if you wanted to play a real historical Napoleon, first, he would be marrying an older woman. That's why she was infertile. That's why he never was able to have children with her. It's because they were not super together. And on top of it, she was getting old. So he was 27. She was 33. Now, what do we get as actors in the movie? Joaquin Phoenix is 48. Vanessa Kirby is 34 at the moment of marriage. So you have, in the movie, you have an old man fucking a relatively beautiful woman for his age. But in reality, you had a relatively fat, geeky Napoleon who was 27 fucking an infertile 33. That is the reality of what happened. And yes, Joaquin Phoenix, having gone through cycles of food deprivation, sorry, I didn't have my mute button. Let me activate it here. Joaquin Phoenix, having gone through cycles of food deprivation and having worked on his facial expression as part of the Joker performance, actually looks maybe a little older than 48, you know? He doesn't look like a sweet face, 48. He looks like a 57, says John Drake. He looks torn by existence. So I made the calculation. For historical realism, the Josephine that you see in the movie is played by Vanessa Kirby accurately, because she's just 1 year older than the real Josephine. But the Joaquin Phoenix is 15 years older than the real Napoleon that he's playing. So that is something to take into account. The movie doesn't capture this reality because of the choice of actors here. It's very annoying at the beginning. There's this song playing as the beginning is the French Revolution, 1790, and Marie Antoinette is getting her head chopped. That is how the movie begins. And they play this music here, sung by Edith Piaf, a performance by Edith Piaf of an actual classical song of the 1790 period, of the true French Revolution. which basically says in French, ça ira, ça ira, ça ira, les aristocrates, on les pendra, which means everything's going to be all right. We're going to hang the aristocrats. It's been 300 years that they have promised us that we will get some bread. It's been 300 years that they gave us parties. And that they entertain prostitutes. It's been 300 years that they crush us. So basically a revolutionary song. The problem is the one that is performed at the beginning is clearly a gramophone recording of Edith Piaf. It's not the way this song was performed in 1790. It's a very original, very modern, new version of this song. And you can hear the gramophone type of recording that you would get somewhere in the 40s, 50s, 60s. You can hear basically the vinyl aspect and the whole microphone aspect of it. If you're going to do an historical reconstruction of 1790 and choose a song that came from 1790, why don't you have a chorus of sing it in the way a crowd could have sung it in 1790? Instead, we get the new recording from the 20th century, basically 150 years later, and it shows in the lack of care of the historical reality here. How would a recording even be playing in 1790 as Marie Antoinette gets her head chopped? This is all sorts of details that are super annoying to someone who just knows basic history. And I'm not a history buff. I'm not hanging up to this kind of details usually. But they come out super obvious. Like, I almost prefer the historical approach of Quentin Tarantino in the Inglourious Basterds. Because at least there's some sort of, okay, we're going to make up a story for why a German officer ends up speaking English to the French farmer, which is like impossible. There's no history in which that happens. But we're going to make up something. And see, Quentin Tarantino just puts it in your face and kind of admits it doesn't make sense, but we're trying to make it make sense to you. Whereas Ridley Scott, here, presents a whole movie where French people all speak English. And this is super annoying because eventually they end up being at war with the French with the English. And it's like, okay, everyone has been speaking English in France for this whole movie. And now the big fight of Waterloo arrives, and who shows up? The English. And now the English are speaking with their, like, The people in France in this movie already had a European, English, UK type of accent. So how are you going to make the English look English? Well, they gave them an even more exaggerated English accent. So it's like the French are there shooting their cannons. And the way this movie distinguishes between the French and the English, they both have the English accent. But they make the English even more English, and also they have cups of teas in their tents. It's like, that is terrible. That is a terrible way here, where my brain is like, well, haven't we been on the side of the English already? Right. They speak English, but it's for the movie, and actually they're French, and Napoleon was French. It's super painful to be digesting these historical annoyances and things that just wouldn't happen. So then the movie starts the first battle. The movie starts with the French Revolution. So 1789, 1790, the chopping of the head of Marie Antoinette, who is said to have kind of like this Ça ira, ça ira song, which is sung by Edith Piaf in that movie, 150 years later. Her head is chopped. There's a theater plays where they mock the chopping of her head. Lots of celebrations around the killing of aristocrats. And then from the disorder that the French Revolution does, France is weakened. And Napoleon starts rising as a military commander because he's asked to take back Toulon, which is a French port city. And there has been the Royal Navy of the British has been bordering the town with its navy and taken over the town. And the idea of Napoleon is, well, we don't need to take the whole town back. We just need to take the to take the fort. And if we have the fort, we have the cannons, and we can totally sink the Royal Navy. And once their navy is synced, we are in the castle or the whatever that location is, the fort. We are in the fort. They have no navy, and then we have the town. So the whole idea is you don't need much men. You just need enough to do the siege of Toulon. People who are history buff, they said that the use of ladders to escalate the fort was absolutely ridiculous, that it never happened, that actually what was used is explosive to pierce a hole in the wall through which the forces of Napoleon were able to enter. And the performance of Joaquin Phoenix is kind of weird. It's kind of overly sweaty. And, you know, the whole movie, Napoleon is just in these clean, aristocratic costumes. But in this scene, he's like, wah, wah. And you can see the sweat on his face. I guess it could have been interesting to have more of this in the movie, to study the contrast between, was Napoleon one of these aristocrats just giving orders like this? Or was he the sweaty type of guy who was getting into it? But I don't know what would be the answer. But it could have been an interesting point, but it's not really exploited in the movie. There's just this weird, sweaty moment of Napoleon just escalating the ladders, and he's like, and then, you know, receiving a cannon. His horse just gets blown. That's one of the, in terms of innovation of battlefield illustration, there isn't much in this movie. It's all stuff we've seen before. But the whole cannoning of a horse, and you can see the internal organs of the horse just, that is a kind of interesting CGI for battle gore. But there's not much to put your teeth onto. In this movie, you're going to have to enjoy the cannon, the horse, because it's almost the only thing that's graphically, that touches like the gore levels of Braveheart. So Josephine, as I indicated previously, the Josephine that is from reality looks like this. So I would say the Josephine performance by the actress is fit. Vanessa Kirby here, she does a fit Josephine with the kind of short hair, dark hair type of thing, aristocrat, psychopath of some kind. It's maybe a little exaggerated, this whole French people only know how to doggy style fuck. Like there's these scenes where Napoleon is fucking her, and it's always doggy style, and it's like, I know it's a thing, like this whole French people, French aristocrats, that's how they fuck, and it's a classic in American cinema to be illustrating some high-level CEO fucking their secretary on the desk and in doggy style performance, but it's kind of overly crude how they film it. you have Joaquin Phoenix just pop, 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 just fucking her super quick in doggy style. I don't know what was the thought process here to kind of make a contrast between their aristocratic manner and the fucking scenes. I think there is a little bit of her personality that is psychopathic exploiting of her pussy. Like, I'm going to show you something. You're going to want it forever. I don't know if it's a historically accurate representation of Josephine, but I guess that it's fair to... This couple had massive problems to it. That is certain from the historical record. So what were the problem, and are they overdone? And is her exploitation of sex having any grasp onto Napoleon? I think that Napoleon comments in his writing in Real History that he's not really swayed by these sexual things, that he considers his accomplishments so much more important, and he's bound to greatness, and ultimately sex only derives from his greatness and his social status. So I think he has an understanding of all this, and he's relatively unaffected. Whereas in the movie, he's not presented as an artist who's unaffected by her advances. He's more like moved by and interested by her advances. My guess is the movie has believed too hard in the letters. My guess is when Napoleon writes these letters, I am so much in love with you and I love you 1,000 times more. I don't think Napoleon feels that way so much. I think Napoleon is more of an abstract thinker and he's not super into sex. Whenever he's there, he wants to have babies, so he does have sex. But the movie presents him as the kind of cuck simp that we see in the letters. What the movie should have understood is the letters are sent maybe with deceptive intent, maybe because it's part of French culture for females to demand this kind of, I love you so much. I couldn't live without you. I mean, that's how French women expect you to act. So much so that I couldn't maintain a French woman in my life. I've been married to one. And she would be, and she makes me think a lot about Josephine because she would be like, I want you to love me so hard. And I'd be like, okay, I love you. I want to have sex with you. I desire your pussy. No, I want you to kneel and be wanting my pussy so hard. And it's like, I'm not into this stuff, lady. I'm sorry. I have limits to just how much desire I can feel about the physical world. I'm sorry. So we see a lot of this conflict in this movie. It tries to illustrate a real thing about French women historically. Is that they are educated into thinking that they're kind of these goddesses that have this weird power over males. And it's kind of annoying when you marry a French woman, honestly, because it's like, yeah, you know, the age of the internet, I can see lots of beautiful women out there. I can order 10,000 JPEGs of absolutely perfect woman. It's going to be very hard for me to have saliva at a 6 out of 10, you know? Joaquin Phoenix, way too old for this movie. I mean, look at this and compare it to Napoleon at the peak height of his realizations. Napoleon was a somewhat fat geek artist that was very young. Joaquin Phoenix is like a deranged old man who's been starved for his last role. It doesn't work. His face doesn't work for this role because he seems too Ruined by Life, which is excellent for a dozen other roles. Like the face of Joaquin Phoenix, just tired by life, is awesome for a director, but it's not awesome for Napoleon, because Napoleon doesn't get to be. Napoleon was, see, he has cheeks. Napoleon is kind of overweight. Napoleon is youthful. He is, he doesn't have all of the veteran aspect of Joaquin Phoenix. And of course, I understand Joaquin Phoenix didn't have the power to recover his youthful baby face. You know, it's impossible to get it back. But maybe it wasn't wise to take Joaquin Phoenix then. Maybe it wasn't. French campaign in Egypt and Syria, completely useless part of the movie, where we see Napoleon bombarding the pyramids. We don't know that this actually happened, but it does happen in the movie. And then he takes over Egypt, and he gets to see the local traders, and they're trading a fully preserved mummy. And then there's like this Joaquin Phoenix Joker moment with the mummy, where it takes like a whole minute where he approaches his hand at the face of the mummy, and now you hear ghost music, and it's like, oh my God, there's going to be something happening. There's a mummy, and there's the whole power of the ghost of Egypt backing her, and he just touches her, and the mummy just falls on the side like this. And it's supposed to be funny, I guess. I guess it's funny how it tries to be funny. But it's like, instead of deepening a truly scripted route of this movie, why do we spend a whole minute on this mummy? It doesn't matter. DK Shadow says, a mummy spinoff. So all of this is just to say Napoleon has taken over Egypt. Now, in Egypt, he learns about the infidelity of Josephine. And as is historically the case, he goes back to France. He returned to her apartment in Milan, only to find it empty. Josephine had left for Genoa, most probably with army officer Hippolyte Charles, with whom she was suspected of having an affair. He waited 9 days for her return, but the wait began to arouse his suspicions. So she's not there when he comes back, and she begs a place back. He accepts her back, but there's suspicion. She's always giving trouble, but he never quite have the time to discipline her and, you know, to correct her behavior, because he's always out there being in demand for his military actions. We then the coup de Brumaire happens, where a bunch of French people in the elite decide to make a coup d'etat. So the way it's represented in the movie is that they take a bunch of politicians, they intimidate them to resign. What happens historically is that they succeed at having 3 of the 5 resign, which removes the ability of a quorum, because now there's only 2 of the 5 people of the directory that are able to vote. The remaining ones, they pack a bunch of the elite on a deceptive story that the France is getting attacked and they need protection. They close them into a room. And in that room, they are arguing and everything. And Napoleon comes out of that room, and the brother of Napoleon makes the promise to the military that, you know, Napoleon is totally dedicated to France. And if he was to betray France with his power, I would stab him in the heart. The movie very poorly presents these whole things. Because let me tell you, I've watched the movie. I didn't understand any of this. I had to go read the page of Wikipedia to understand what was going on in this part of the movie. Because the movie just throws you and these random French people arguing in a room. I didn't understand that they were put there with a ruse. The ruse was not presented at all. So you just end up saying, okay, there's a bunch of guys arguing and Napoleon was in trouble. Eventually they force with guns, they force the two remaining ones to abdicate power. And that's basically a coup d'etat that gives total power to Napoleon. Another thing that is not exploited in the movie is that this whole thing that Josephine is an old, infertile woman from the perspective of Napoleon, who's younger, that's already an injustice. But there's a parallel story that wasn't at all exploited, and it could have been good. Lucien Bonaparte, the brother of Napoleon, is fucking the daughter of Josephine. Daughter. I'm trying to find the reference. Anyways, there's a relationship between the brother of Napoleon and the woman that he's with, and that could have been exploited. And again, it would have made contrast with the fact that Napoleon was fucking an older woman. You don't get the genes, you don't get the reproduction, but you're kind of a sterile worker for your brother, and he gets the actual productive pussy. None of this has been exploited. At some point, we see what I think is the brother of Napoleon at the same table. And there's a big argument between Josephine and Napoleon at this point. And maybe the daughter of Josephine is seated beside Lucien. But that would be the only reference I see to this relationship. And that would be interesting because the daughter is fertile. The daughter gets fucked. That is kind of stepfather porn type of action that I would like to have seen. But no, it doesn't happen at all. At this argument that they have at the table, you have Napoleon saying, "You're going to bear a baby from me tonight, or I'm going to get a divorce." So it's interesting to see that basically the big problem of this couple is that they try having baby and they can't. And she says, "There's not enough love making in this house for me to have a baby." And Napoleon says, "There's been plenty of it. And in fact, not just by me." Napoleon is essentially saying, even with the collective effort of many men in Paris, we all fucked you. And there's no babies coming out of you. That is like the ultimate cock position. The ultimate cock winning an argument. It's a hilarious part of the movie, but yeah, I mean, that is also historically real, that Napoleon eventually has to get a divorce from Josephine because he has to produce a baby if he's going to take so much power, and this power could be inherited by inheritance to a heir. He has to have a heir, and so he eventually divorces. But before this, we have a scene of the coronation. So Napoleon puts the crown onto the head of Josephine. And that's an illustration of what's also present in the movie. The coronation of Napoleon, also historically accurate based on this painting, where Napoleon puts the crown of the queen, kind of, onto Josephine. Then Napoleon, I don't know if it's before the divorce or after the divorce. I think it may be after. He goes to Austerlitz, and we have some of the interesting battle scenes, maybe, of the movie, although it doesn't expand very much. It could have been more epic. It could have been more long, but Napoleon crushes the Austro-Russian army in Austerlitz. And that is a classical moment where that was represented in paintings before. So basically, that's a representation of the Austerlitz battle, in which there was a strategy over 3 or 4 months, because what you learn is that the way that the Russians fight is very much by fleeing and by using the temperature changes to their advantage. So they're hard to catch, they flee away, and then winter comes and kills you. That's basically what they do. And I think it's a pretty genius strategy. They do it twice in the movie, once at Austerlitz and once at Moscow. So at Austerlitz, though, Napoleon had the better of it. Because Napoleon, over 3 or 4 months, in the real history of this, he pushes these troops by using their fleeing reaction. And he leads the war of attrition against them. Of course, they have these techniques where they stay in the snow and they're hiding in the forest, and they just shoot 3-4 cannons to the line of marching French people, French army, and then they withdraw. So they have much lighter cannons, and they're much more deployable in surprise locations. So that's a war of attrition that actually has weakened Napoleon throughout this campaign. He loses a lot of men. But eventually, he gets their pattern, and he gets to push them by over 3-4 months toward a place where they will be caught, a kind of valley where there's a lake. And the lake is frozen, so at first they think they can march on it. But eventually, Napoleon bombards the lake with his cannons, which he had hidden on a stand nearby. And so they all fall into the water and they die from the cold of the water. Now, the history buffs are saying, well, you know, historically, there may have been just 3 or 4 men who have drowned in the water. Whereas in the movie, it's like he drowns the whole army. He shows it as if it was a victory. We don't see 20,000 people drowning, but the movie kind of suggests that this resolved the whole war and that somehow this was a massively good strategy for Napoleon. Here we have another painting representation of this scene. It's well represented in the movie. Not being a history buff and not caring that much about these details, I'm okay with these scenes, but they could have been deeper. You know, in Braveheart, there's the build-up, there's the collision between the armies, and then there's the gore, just cranium bashing. There's not much cranium bashing happening here. And, you know, if they're going to drown, don't just show me 5 seconds of them drowning. Show me the distress of the guy and he freezes and he starts having neurological effects. Show me some gore here. We don't get to see any of this because it's too quick, too short, too superficial. So after the divorce, well, even before the divorce, after Josephine had betrayed Napoleon, we know historically that he's still trusting her after this, you know, forgiving her in a way, but he's also taking his own mistresses. And so Napoleon did end up having many illegitimate children. And in the movie, it's not clear, is there a prostitute that he fucks? Or is that his new wife? Eventually, he ends up marrying the Austrian Marie-Louise. Now, it's not clear to me what the movie suggests here. I'm confused. I think that he succeeds at impregnating Marie-Louise, which is true. But I think in the movie, he takes the baby and brings it to Josephine for her to raise the baby of Marie-Louise. I'm not sure if I understood correctly, because when you watch a movie, you can't follow all of the details, but it seems that in the movie, he carries a baby from Marie-Louise to Josephine. And so this infertile woman gets to care for the baby. I'm not sure about this. Anyways, it's not factually accurate. as far as I know, from the history, Marie-Louise is a 20-year-old fertile female. He gets a baby with her. She raises the baby in Austria, and he ends up dying of tuberculosis at the age of 21, according to this website, at least. He named this baby the King of Rome, but since eventually Napoleon fell, it didn't end up meaning anything. So before marrying Marie-Louise, he gets an official divorce, the civil annulment, also a accurate historical representation. Dino Logovic says, great film, JF, The Duelist, Ridley's first film. Okay, I'll keep a note on this. I'll see if that's worth watching. And finally, the two final battles of the movie. The French occupation of Moscow, where they reach Moscow, but the tactic of the Russians still the same. They have fled Moscow. And they have put a large section of Moscow, in fact, on fire. So they're like, all right, you think that was the end of your travel? If you really want to beat us, you're going to have to go even deeper into Russia. You're going to be faced with the winter, and you're going to die. So basically, Moscow abandoned and put on fire. That's an actual historical event, although the historians are not sure who started the fire. It is said that it was the Russians, as part of a scorched earth strategy. In any case, Napoleon cannot get deeper towards St. Petersburg, cannot get deeper into Russia because the winter is coming, and it's kind of a Pyrrhic, it's a victory that is that comes at high cost, because they made all this travel, all of this for the battle not to happen, and so they won, but they won a burnt Moscow, which eventually will be rebuilt by the Russians. And finally, the Battle of Waterloo. The Battle of Waterloo is represented as, well, now that Napoleon is coming back to France, there's all sorts of kingdoms around France that are annoyed. They're all scared of Napoleon being too powerful in Europe, so they team up. Netherlands, English, other countries are also in, but they don't matter so much for the battle. So Napoleon sees all of this major army gathering against him, and he merely has a bunch of French soldier nationalists that are kind of loyalist to him, despite the fact that he doesn't have any official standing anymore. So he's definitely outnumbered, but he decides to make a gambit that if he can attack those armies before they gather together, he can beat them one at a time and face a smaller number of them. So basically his goal is to attack quick, before these armies are given the chance to regroup and be together, because at that time they would be way too numerous for him to handle. So that is the history of the Battle of Waterloo. He attacks with his cannons, and it's kind of ridiculous. It's kind of weird. The movie doesn't intellectually accompany you through this to understand what the fuck is going on in Napoleon's head. He's sending all of his troops to die. And the movie presents this well. You know, they're going there and they're dying and they're totally outnumbered and losing. But it keeps going and Napoleon keeps sending the orders. And the movie, I don't know if it could have, through narration or through intelligent character placement, could have explained better. I would have wanted to understand better. Why is Napoleon doing all this? Does he believe he will win, or is it just like a last suicide desperate move? We don't even get a thesis in the movie. He just does it. Napoleon is like, send in the infantry. Okay. And then there's the whole key formation of the English. They form a square, and it's a square of infantry. And the horses, the cavalry, as they attack these squares, the horses have the kind of natural reaction not to go into the spears, but they start running in round around the squares. They are squares of like 200, 300 people, maybe more. 200, 300 people with guns and with bayonets. And so the horses don't charge the square because they're scared of the bayonet. So they start running around the square. And this leaves all of the time for the guns to be used to shoot all these horses. So it's a kind of human formation that outcompetes the cavalry. And that seems to be a key to the victory of the English against Napoleon. So he loses the Battle of Waterloo, but the English kidnap him and they don't kill him. They decide not to kill him. And he's already, as he's just handcuffed and in some sort of prison place, but he's not even handcuffed. He's actually living as an aristocrat prisoner. Because they get him, we can see him eating oysters, I think, and he's already teaching to the youth English soldier his old strategies, and he's explaining that he lost the Battle of Waterloo because although he knows how to precisely set the angle of a cannon, he doesn't know how to communicate this to his lower armies, and so training has always been the problem of Napoleon because he's too autistic. That is how the movie finishes. And the English decide to give him a good life on an island where he will be banished from entering Europe, but he can keep living on the island. And I believe we see him at the end of the movie with his children. So that is what the movie is. New guy says it wasn't a matter of aiming cannons, Jesus. Well, that is that the movie doesn't tell you this is the reason he lost. The movie tells you this is the excuse that he would use to look good in front of the youth. New guy says they poisoned him. Really? Do they poison him at the end of the movie? Maybe I missed the last minutes, but I don't. This movie doesn't seem like he was poisoned. I don't know. Maybe I didn't pay attention at the very end, but the oysters looked okay. Anyways, what I retain from this movie is that if you make a historical epic where you allow yourself, okay, in real life he was poisoned. Okay, I didn't know. If you make a historical epic in which you are allowing yourself violations of historical reality, I'm all fine about it. But you have to make your story more interesting than reality. Napoleon is not more interesting than the Wikipedia pages I read about it, and that's a big problem. So that is it for tonight. Sam says, c'était carrément injuste. Cloud Warmer says, JF, was she recording for OnlyFans or unable to find sex in 2021? News only released now. Oh, yeah, this is a bizarre meme. A meme that has emerged. A woman caught performing intimate act near families on Georgia Beach is seen in new body cam breaking down while telling cops she was stressed. So this woman, the cops approach her and they ask her, have you been doing anything weird? We've received calls. And she was on the beach inserting a vibrator in her pussy. And they arrest her for public indecency. Because there are families that saw her do it. I don't particularly care about this story. Why is the body cam footage emerging now, years later? Maybe it's because sometimes in these legal things, it takes a lot of time before the court process starts and the evidence submission starts. And the police often has a rule not to release evidence until the court process begins. So that is probably why we get it today. Was she cute or ugly? Oh, she's very cute and all. You know, that's probably why it's memeing a lot. She has a Christian cross here. Christian woman. So if you're looking for it, it would seem that she is looking for a phallic shape that can vibrate at a certain frequency. Perhaps you can be that. You can be what she's looking for. So you might want to go and check if she's single. Doubting Thomas says, besides theories you give, might a reason for European susceptibility for self-hatred compared to other groups be related to our proclivity for sibling rivalry and intra-clan conflict? For example, we tend to have more estrangements in our families and more civil and continental war. I don't know that this is true. You go check in the average black family in America, you're going to have all sorts of this uncle is evil and this uncle raped me and we're not talking to this side of the family because of that. I don't know that it's that you're starting with a true premise here. I don't even know that we have more intra-clan conflict. You might take the wars of Europe, like the wars of Napoleon as an example, but for every invasions of Napoleon, you're going to have some Bantu African tribe outcompeting some other Bantu African tribe or whatever. So I think that we record historically those things better because we're a more developed civilization, but I don't know that we have inherently more internal conflict than out there. I mean, go into India and start learning about the castes and this gang and same thing in Japan, you know. So I don't think we are exceptional on this. I just think we have a better recording of biographical facts, maybe including our family-related ones. Claude Warmer says, JF, if that was a man, they would get 10K years in a dungeon. Yeah, so there's this this classical thing of females doing that kind of thing have been subject to extreme lenience historically. But I think that the modern police is very much aware of the possibility of female bias, male bias, and I think that's why she's going through the true prosecution here. It's because they're like, hey, we're not going to let you go because you're a woman. That is it for tonight, boys. Thank you so much. And if you'd like to support the show, join the Subscribestar or the Patreon. Your monthly support is essential for the show to keep going. Thank you very much for being here, and I will see you all tomorrow. Thank you.